emerald delicate thing it was. Now, they were just dancing. Arnie's cheerful eyes were also opaque, and he would have sworn to it, watchful.
Sure, I gave my mother a hard time. Lee, too, I guess. It was just the shock of seeing all that work. All that work down the tubes.
He shook his head.
Bad news.
Are you gonna be able to do anything with it? Arnie brightened immediately. Really brightened this time, Dennis felt.
Sure, I already have. You wouldn't believe it, Dennis. If you'd seen the way it looked in that parking lot, they made them tough in those days. Not like now, when all this stuff that looks like metal is really just shiny plastic. That car's nothing but a damn tank. The glass was the worst part, and the tires, of course. They slashed the tires.
What about the engine?
Never got at it,
Arnie said promptly. And that was the first lie. They had been at it, all right. When Arnie and Lee had gotten to Christine that afternoon, the distributor cap had been lying on the pavement. Lee had recognized it and had told Dennis about it. What else had they done under the hood, Dennis wondered. The radiator? If someone was going to use a tire iron to punch holes in the bodywork, might they not be apt to use the same tool to spring the radiator in a few places? What about the plugs, the voltage regulator, the carburetor?
Arnie, why are you lying to me?
So what are you doing with it now? Dennis asked.
Spending money on it, what else?
Arnie said, and laughed his almost genuine laugh. Dennis might even have accepted it as genuine if he hadn't heard the real article once or twice over the Thanksgiving supper Arnie had brought.
New tires, new glass, got some bodywork to do, and then it'll be as good as new.
As good as new. But Lee had said that they had found something that was little more than a smashed hulk, a carny three swings for a quarter derelict.
Why are you lying?
For a cold moment, he found himself wondering if maybe Arnie hadn't gone a little crazy. But no, that wasn't the impression he gave. The feeling Dennis got from him was one of furtiveness, craftiness. Then, for the first time, the crazy thought came to him, the thought that maybe Arnie was only half-lying, trying to lay a groundwork of plausibility for what? A case of spontaneous regeneration? That was pretty crazy, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
It was indeed, Dennis thought, unless you had happened to see a mass of cracks in a windshield seem to shrink between one viewing and the next.
Just a trick of the light.
That's what you thought then, and you were right. But a trick of the light didn't explain the haphazard way Arnie had gone about rebuilding Christine, the hopscotch of old and new parts. It didn't explain that weird feeling Dennis had gotten sitting behind the wheel of Christine in LeBay's garage, or the sense, after the new tire had been put on en route to Darnell's, that he was looking at an old car picture with a new car picture directly underlying it, and that a hole had been cut out of the old car picture at that spot where one of the old car tires had been. And nothing explained Arnie's lie now, or the narrow, thoughtful way he was watching Dennis to see if his lie was going to be accepted. So he smiled, a big, easy, relieved grin.
Well, that's great, he said.
Arnie's narrow, evaluating expression held for a moment longer. Then he smiled an aw-shucks grin and shrugged.
Luck, he said. When I think of the things they could have done... Sugar in the gas tank, molasses in the car. They were stupid. Lucky for me.
Repperton and his merry crew? Dennis asked quietly. The suspicious look, so dark and unlike Arnie, appeared again, and then sank from sight. Arnie looked grim now, grim and morose. He seemed to speak, then sighed instead.
Yeah, he said. Who else?
But you didn't report it.
My dad did.
That's what Lee said.
What else did she tell you?
Arnie asked, sharply. Nothing, and I didn't ask, Dennis said, holding his hand out. Your business, Arnie. Peace.
Sure.
He laughed a little, and then passed a hand over his face.
Still not over it. Fuck. I don't think I'm ever going to be over it, Dennis. Coming into that parking lot with Lee, feeling like I was on top of the world, and seeing...
Won't they just do it again if you fix her up again? Arnie's face went dead cold, set.
They won't do it again, he said.
His gray eyes were like March ice, and Dennis found himself suddenly very glad he wasn't Buddy Repperton.
What do you mean? I'll be parking it at home, that's what I mean, he said,
and once more his face broke into that large, cheerful, unnatural grin.
What'd you think I meant?
Nothing, Dennis said. The image of ice remained. Now it was a feeling of thin ice, creaking uneasily under his feet. Beneath that, black, cold water.
But I don't know, Arnie. You seem awful sure that Buddy wants to let this go.
I'm hoping he'll see it as a standoff, Arnie said quietly. We got him expelled from school.
He got himself expelled, Dennis said hotly. He pulled a knife. Hell, it wasn't even a knife, it was a goddamn pig sticker.
I'm just telling it the way he'll see it, Arnie said,
then held out his hand and laughed.
Peace.
Yeah. Okay.
We got him expelled, or more accurately, I did, and he and his buddies beat hell out of Christine. Evens. The end.
Yeah, if he sees it that way.
I think he will, Arnie said. The cops questioned him, and Moochie Welch and Richie Trelawney. Scared them. And almost got Sandy Galton to confess, I guess.
Arnie's lip curled.
Fucking crybaby.
This was so unlike Arnie, the old Arnie, that Dennis sat up in bed without thinking and then winced at the pain in his back and lay down again quickly.
Jesus, man. You sound like you want him to stonewall it. I don't care what he or any of those shitters do, Arnie said,
and then in a strangely offhand voice he added,
It doesn't matter anymore anyhow.
Dennis said, Arnie, are you all right? And for a moment, a look of desperate sadness passed over Arnie's face. More than sadness. He looked harried and haunted. It was the face Dennis thought later. It is so easy to see these things later. Too much later. Of someone so bewildered and entangled and weary of struggling that he hardly knows anymore what it is he's doing. Then that expression, like that other look of dark suspicion, was gone.
Sure, he said. I'm great. Except that you're not the only one with a hurt back. You remember when I strained it at Philly Plains?
Dennis nodded.
Check this out.
He stood up and pulled his shirt out of his pants. Something seemed to dance in his eyes, something flipping and turning at a black depth. He lifted his shirt. It wasn't old-fashioned like LeBay's. It was cleaner, too. A neat, seemingly unbroken band of lycra about 12 inches across. But, Dennis thought, a brace was a brace. It was too close to LeBay for comfort.
I put another hurt on it getting Christine back to Will's, Arnie said. I don't even remember how I did it. That's how upset I was. Hooking her up to the wrecker, I guess. But I don't know for sure. At first it wasn't too bad. Then it got worse. Dr. Masha prescribed... Dennis,
are you okay?
With what felt like a fantastic effort, Dennis kept his voice even. He moved his features around into an expression which felt at least faintly like pleasant interest. And still, there was that something dancing in Arnie's eyes. Dancing and dancing.
You'll shake it off, Dennis said.
Sure, I imagine,
Arnie said, tucking his shirt back in around the back brace.
I'm just supposed to watch what I lift, so I don't do it again.
He smiled at Dennis.
If there was still a draft, it'd keep me out of the army, he said.
Once again, Dennis restrained himself from any movement that could have been interpreted as surprise, but he put his arms under the bed's top sheet. At the sight of that back brace, so like LeBay's, they had broken out in gooseflesh.
Arnie's eyes, like black water under thin gray March ice, black water and glee dancing far down within them like the twisting, decomposing body of a drowned man.
"Listen," Arnie said briskly, "I gotta move. Hope you don't think I could hang around a lousy place like this all night."
"That's you, always in demand," Dennis said.
"Seriously, man. Thanks.
You cheered up a grim day."
For one strange instant, he thought Arnie was going to weep. That dancing thing down deep in his eyes was gone, and his friend was there, really there. Then Arnie smiled sincerely.
"Just remember one thing, Dennis. Nobody misses you.
Nobody at all."
"Eat me raw through a flavor straw," Dennis said solemnly. Arnie gave him the finger. The formalities were now complete. Arnie could leave. He gathered up his brown shopping bag, considerably deflated, candle holders and empty beer bottles clinking inside. Dennis had a sudden inspiration. He rapped his knuckles on his leg cast.
"Sign this, Arnie, would you?"
"I already did, didn't I?"
"Yeah, but it wore off. Sign it again?"
Arnie shrugged.
"If you got a pen."
Dennis gave him one from the drawer of the night table. Grinning, Arnie bent over the cast, which was hoisted to an angle over the bed with a series of weights and pulleys, found white space in the intaglio of names and mottos, and scribbled, "For Dennis Gilder, the world's biggest dork. Arnie Cunningham." He patted the cast when he was done and handed the pen back to Dennis.
"Okay?"
"Yeah,"
Dennis said. "Thanks.
Stay loose, Arnie."
"You know it. Happy Thanksgiving."
"Same to you." Arnie left. Later on, Dennis's mother and father came in. Ellie, apparently exhausted by the day's hilarity, had gone home to bed. On their way home, the Gilders commented to each other on how withdrawn Dennis had seemed.
"He was in a blue study, all right," Gilder said. "Holidays in the hospital aren't any fun."
As for Dennis himself, he spent a long and thoughtful time that evening examining two signatures. Arnie had indeed signed his cast, but at a time when both of Dennis's legs had been in full leg casts. That first time, he had signed the cast on the right leg, which had been up in the air when Arnie came in. Tonight, he had signed the left. Dennis buzzed for a nurse and used all his charm, persuading her to lower his left leg so he could compare the two signatures side by side. The cast on his right leg had been cut down and would come off altogether in a week or 10 days. Arnie's signature had not rubbed off. That had been one of Dennis's lies. But it had very nearly been cut off. Arnie had not written a message on the right leg, only his signature. With some effort and some pain, Dennis and the nurse were able to maneuver his legs close enough together so he could study the two signatures side by side. In a voice so dry and cracked he was hardly able to recognize it as his own, he asked the nurse,
"Do they look the same to you?"
"No," the nurse said. "I've heard of forging checks, but never casts. Is it a joke?"
"Sure,"
Dennis said, feeling an icy coldness rise from his stomach to his chest.
"It's a joke."
He looked at the signatures. He looked at them side by side and felt that rising coldness steal all through him, lowering his body temperature, making the hairs on the back of his neck stir and stiffen. They were nothing alike. Late that Thanksgiving night, a cold wind rose, first gusting, then blowing steadily. The clear eye of the moon stared down from a black sky. The last brown and withered leaves of autumn were ripped from the trees and then harried through the gutters. They made a sound like rolling bones. Winter had come to Libertyville.
Chapter 30. Moochie Welch. The Thursday after Thanksgiving was the last day of November, the night that Jackson Browne played the Pittsburgh Civic Center to a sellout crowd. Moochie Welch went up with Richie Trelawney and Nicky Billingham, but got separated from them even before the show began. He was spare changing, and whether it was because the impending Brown concert had created some extremely mellow vibes, or because he was becoming something of an endearing feature, Moochie, a romantic, liked to believe the latter, he had had a remarkably good night. He had collected nearly $30 worth of spare change. It was distributed among all his pockets. Moochie jingled like a piggy bank. Thumbing home had been remarkably easy, too, with all the traffic leaving the Civic Center. The concert ended at 11:40, and he was back in Libertyville shortly after 1:15. His last ride was with a young guy who was headed back to Prestonville on Route 63. The guy dropped him at the 376 ramp on JFK Drive. Moochie decided to walk up to Vandenberg's Happy Gas and see Buddy. Buddy had a car, which meant that Moochie, who lived far out on Kingsfield Pike, wouldn't have to walk home. It was hard work hitching rides once you got out in the boonies, and the Kingsfield Pike was boondock city. It meant he wouldn't be home until well past dawn, but in cold weather a sure ride was not to be sneezed at, and Buddy might have a bottle. He had walked a quarter of a mile from the 376 exit ramp in the deep single-number cold, his cleated heels clicking on the deserted sidewalk, his shadow waxing and waning under the eerie orange street lamps, and he had still perhaps a mile to go when he saw the car parked at the curb up ahead. Exhaust curled out of its twin pipes and hung in the perfectly still air, clouding it, before drifting lazily away in stacked layers. The grill, bright chrome highlighted with pricks of orange light, looked at him like a grinning idiot mouth. Moochie recognized the car. It was a two-tone Plymouth. In the light of the maximum illumination street lamps, the two tones seemed to be ivory and dried blood. It was Christine. Moochie stopped, and a stupid sort of wonder flooded through him. It was not fear, at least not at that moment. It couldn't be Christine. That was impossible. They had punched a dozen holes in the radiator of Cuntface's car. They had dumped a nearly full bottle of Texas Driver into the carb, and Buddy had produced a 5-pound sack of Domino sugar, which he had funneled into the gas tank through Moochie's cupped hands. And all of that was just for starters. Buddy had demonstrated a kind of furious invention when it came to destroying Cuntface's car. It had left Moochie feeling both delighted and uneasy. All in all, that car should not have moved under its own power for 6 months, if ever. So this could not be Christine. It was some other 58 Fury. Except it was Christine. He knew it. Moochie stood there on the deserted early morning sidewalk, his numb ears poking out from beneath his long hair, his breath pluming frostily on the air. The car sat at the curb, facing him, engine growling softly. It was impossible to tell who, if anyone, was behind the wheel. It was parked directly beneath one of the streetlights, and the orange globe burned across the glass of the unmarred windshield like a waterproof jack-o'-lantern seen deep down in dark water. Moochie began to be afraid. He slicked his tongue over dry lips and looked around. To his left was JFK Drive, 6 lanes wide and looking like a dry riverbed at this empty hour of the morning. To his right was a photography shop, orange letters outlined in red spelling Kodak across its window. He looked back at the car. It just sat there, idling. He opened his mouth to speak and produced no sound. He tried again and got a croak. "Hey, Cunningham!" The car sat, seemed to brood, exhaust curled up. The engine rumbled, idling fat on high-test gas. "That you, Cunningham?" He took one more step. A cleat scraped on cement. His heart was thudding in his neck. He looked around at the street again. Surely another car would come. JFK Drive couldn't be totally deserted, even at 1:25 in the morning, could it? But there were no cars. Only the flat orange glare of the streetlights. Moochie cleared his throat. "You ain't mad, are you?" Christine's duel suddenly came on, pinning him in harsh, white light. The fury ripped toward him, peeling out, the tires screaming black slashes of rubber into the pavement. It came with such sudden power that the rear end seemed to squat like the haunches of a dog preparing to spring, a dog or a she-wolf. The onside wheels jumped up on the pavement and it ran at Moochie that way, offside wheels down, onside wheels up over the curb, canted at an angle. The undercarriage scraped and shrieked and shot off a swirling flicker of sparks. Moochie screamed and tried to sidestep. The edge of Christine's bumper barely flicked his left calf and took a chunk of meat. Warm wetness coursed down his leg and puddled in his shoe. The warmth of his own blood made him realize in a confused way just how cold the night was. He thudded hip first into the doorway of the photo shop, barely missing the plate glass window. A foot to the left, and he would have crashed right through, landing in a litter of Nikons and Polaroid One Steps. He could hear the car's engine suddenly revving up, that horrible, unearthly shrieking of the undercarriage on the cement again. Moochie turned around, panting harshly. Christine was reversing back up the gutter, and as it passed him, he saw. He saw. There was no one behind the wheel. Panic began to pound in his head. Moochie took to his heels. He ran out into JFK Drive, sprinting for the far side. There was an alley over there between a market and a dry cleaning place, too narrow for the car. If he could get in there... Change jingled madly in his pants pockets and in the five or six pockets of his army surplus duffel coat. Quarters, nickels, dimes, a jingling silver carillon. He pumped his knees almost to his chin. His cleated engineer boots drummed the pavement. His shadow chased him. The car somewhere behind him revved again. Fell off. Revved again. Fell off. And then the motor began to shriek. The tires wailed and Christine shot at Moochie Welch's back, crossing the lanes of JFK Drive at right angles. Moochie screamed and could not hear himself scream because the car was still peeling rubber. The car was still shrieking like an insanely angry, murderous woman, and that shriek filled the world. His shadow was no longer chasing him. It was leading him and getting longer. In the window of the dry cleaning shop, he saw great yellow eyes blossom. It wasn't even close. At the very last moment, Moochie tried to jig left, but Christine jigged with him, as if she had read his final desperate thought. The Plymouth hit him squarely, still accelerating, breaking Moochie Welch's back and knocking him spang out of his engineer's boots. He was thrown 40 feet into the brick siding of the little market, again narrowly missing a plunge through a plate glass window. The force of his strike was hard enough to cause him to rebound into the street again, leaving a splash of blood on the brick like an ink blot. A picture of it would appear the next day on the front page of the Libertyville Keystone. Christine reversed, screeched to a skidding, sliding stop, and roared forward again. Moochie lay near the curbing, trying to get up. He couldn't get up. Nothing seemed to work. All the signals were scrambled. Bright, white light washed over him. "No," he whispered through a mouthful of broken teeth. The car roared forward and over him. Change flew everywhere. Moochie was pulled and rolled, first one way and then the other, as Christine reversed into the street again. She stood there, engine revving and falling off to a rich idle, then revving again. She stood there, as if thinking. Then she came at him again. She hit him, jumped the curb, skidded around, and then reversed again, thumping back down. She screamed forward and back. And forward. Her headlights glared, her exhaust pipes jetted hot blue smoke. The thing in the street no longer looked like a human being. It looked like a scattered bundle of rags. The car reversed a final time, skidded around in a half circle, and accelerated, roaring over the bleeding bundle in the street again, and going down the drive, the blast of its engine still winding up to full rev, racketing off the walls of the sleeping buildings. But not entirely sleeping now. Lights were beginning to flick on. People who lived over their stores were going to their windows to see what all the racket had been about, and if there had been an accident. One of Christine's headlights had been shattered. Another flickered unsteadily off and on, bleared with a thin wash of Moochie's blood. The grill had been bent inward, and the dents in it approximated the shape and size of Mucci's torso, with all the gruesome perfection of a death mask. Blood was splashed across the hood in fans that spread out as wind speed increased. The exhaust had taken on a heavy, blatting sound. One of Christine's two mufflers had been destroyed. Inside, on the instrument panel, the odometer continued to run backward, as if Christine were somehow slipping back into time, leaving not only the scene of the hit-and-run behind, but the actual fact of the hit-and-run. The muffler was the first thing. Suddenly that heavy, blatting sound diminished and smoothed out. The fans of blood on the hood began to run toward the front of the car again, in spite of the wind, as if a movie film had been reversed. The flickering headlight suddenly shone steadily, and a tenth of a mile later, the deadlight became a headlight again. With an unimportant tinkling sound, no more than the sound of a small boy's boot breaking the thin scum of ice on a mud puddle, the glass reassembled itself from nowhere. There was a hollow punk, punk, punk sound from the front end, the sound of denting metal, the sound you sometimes get when you squeeze a beer can. But instead of denting, Christine's grill was popping back out. A body shop veteran with 50 years' experience in putting fender benders right could not have done it more neatly. Christine turned onto Hampton Street even before the first of those awakened by the screaming of her tires had reached Mucci's remains. The blood was gone. It had reached the front of the hood and disappeared. The scratches were gone. As she rolled quietly toward the garage door with its honk for entry sign, there was one final punk as the last dimple, this one in the left front bumper, the spot where Christine had struck Mucci's calf, popped back out. Christine looked like new. The car stopped in front of the large garage door in the middle of the darkened, silent building. There was a small plastic box clipped to the driver's side sun visor. This was a little doodad Will Darnell had given Arnie when Arnie began to run cigarettes and booze over into New York State for him. It was, perhaps, Darnell's version of a gold key to the crapper. In the still air, the door opener hummed briefly, and the garage door rattled obediently up. Another circuit was made by the rising door, and a few interior lights came on, burning weakly. The headlight knob on the dashboard suddenly went in, and Christine's duals went out. She rolled inside and whispered across the oil-stained concrete to stall 20. Behind her, the overhead door, which had been set on a 30-second timer, rolled back down. The light circuit was broken, and the garage was dark again. In Christine's ignition switch, the keys dangling down suddenly turned to the left. The engine died. The leather patch with the initials RDL branded into it swung back and forth in decreasing arcs and was finally still. Christine sat in the dark, and the only sound in Darnell's do-it-yourself garage was the slow tick of her cooling engine. Chapter 31. The Day After. Arnie Cunningham did not go to school the next day. He said he thought he might be coming down with the flu. But that evening he told his parents that he felt enough improved to go down to Darnell's and do some work on Christine. Regina protested. Although she did not come right out and say so, she thought Arnie looked like death warmed over. His face was now entirely free of acne and blemishes, but there was a trade-off. It was much too pale, and there were dark circles under his eyes, as if he hadn't been sleeping. In addition, he was still limping. She wondered uneasily if her son could be using some sort of drug, if perhaps he had hurt his back worse than he had let on and had started taking pills so he could go on working on the goddamn car. Then she dismissed the thought. Obsessed as he might be with the car, Arnie would not be that stupid. "I'm really fine, Mom," he said. "You don't look fine, and you hardly touched your supper."
"I'll get some chow later on."
"How's your back? You're not lifting a lot of heavy stuff down there, are you?"
"No, Mom."
This was a lie, and his back had hurt terribly all day long. This was the worst it had been since the original injury at Philly Plains.
"Oh, is that where it started?"
his mind whispered.
Oh, really? Are you sure?
He had taken the brace off for a while, and his back had throbbed fit to kill him. He had put it on again after only 15 minutes, cinching it tighter than ever. Now his back really was a little better, and he knew why. He was going to her. That was why. Regina looked at him, worried and at a loss. For the first time in her life, she simply did not know how to proceed. Arnie was beyond her control now. Knowing it brought on a horrible feeling of despair that sometimes crept up on her and filled her brain with an awful, empty, rotten coldness. At these times, a depression so total she could barely credit it would steal through her, making her wonder exactly what it was she had lived her life for. So her son could fall in love with a girl and a car all in the same terrible fall? Was that it? So she could see exactly how hateful to him she had become when she looked in his gray eyes. Was that it? And it really didn't have anything to do with the girl at all, did it? No. In her mind, it always came back to the car. Her rest had become broken and uneasy, and for the first time since her miscarriage nearly 20 years before, she had found herself considering making an appointment with Dr. Masha to see if he would give her some pill for the stress and the depression and the attendant insomnia. She thought about Arnie on her long sleepless nights, and about mistakes that could never be rectified. She thought about how time had a way of swinging the balance of power on its axis, and how old age had a way of sometimes looking through a dressing table mirror like the hand of a corpse poking through eroded earth. "Will you be back early?" she asked, knowing this was the last breastwork of the truly powerless parent, hating it, unable now to change it. "Sure," he said, but she didn't much trust the way he said it.
"Arnie, I wish you'd stay home. You really don't look good at all."
"I'll be fine," he said. "Gotta be. I have to run some auto parts over to Jamesburg for Will tomorrow." "Not if you're sick," she said. "That's nearly 150 miles.
"Don't worry."
He kissed her cheek, the passionless kiss on the cheek of cocktail party acquaintances. He was opening the kitchen door to go out when Regina asked,
"Did you know the boy who was run down last night on Kennedy Drive?"
He turned back to look at her, his face expressionless.
"What?"
"The paper said he went to Libertyville."
"Oh, the hit and run. That's what you're talking about."
"Yes?"
"I had a class with him when I was a freshman," Arnie said. "I think. No. I really didn't know him, Mom."
"Oh," she nodded, pleased. "That's good. The paper said there were residues of drugs in his system." "You'd never take drugs, would you, Arnie?"
Arnie smiled gently at her pallid, watchful face.
"No, Mom," he said.
"And if your back started to hurt you, I mean, if it really started to hurt you, you'd go see Dr. Masha about it, wouldn't you? You wouldn't buy anything from a drug pusher, would you?"
"No, Mom," he repeated, and went out.
There had been more snow. Another thaw had melted most of it, but this time it had not disappeared completely. It had only withdrawn into the shadows, where it formed a white rime under hedges, the bases of trees, the overhangs of the garage. But in spite of the snow around the edges, or maybe because of it, their lawn looked oddly green as Arnie stepped out into the twilight, and his father looked like a strange refugee from summer as he raked the last of the autumn leaves. Arnie raised his hand briefly to his father and made as if to go past without speaking. Michael called him over. Arnie went reluctantly. He didn't want to be late for his bus. His father had also aged in the storms that had blown up over Christine, although other things had undoubtedly played a part. He had made a bid for the chairmanship of the history department at Horlicks late in the summer, and had been rebuffed quite soundly. And during his annual October checkup, the doctor had pointed out an incipient phlebitis problem. Phlebitis, which had nearly killed Nixon. Phlebitis, an old folks' problem. As that late fall moved toward another gray western Pennsylvania winter, Michael Cunningham looked gloomier than ever.
Hi, Dad. Listen, I've gotta hurry if I'm gonna catch...
Michael looked up from the little pile of frozen brown leaves he had managed to get together. The sunset caught the planes of his face and appeared to make them bleed. Arnie stepped back involuntarily, a little shocked. His father's face was haggard.
Arnold, he said, where were you last night?
What?
Arnie gaped, then closed his mouth slowly.
Why, here. Here, Dad. You know that.
All night?
Of course, I went to bed at 10 o'clock. I was bushed. Why?
Because I had a call from the police today, Michael said, about that boy who was run over on JFK Drive last night.
Moochie Welch, Arnie said.
He looked at his father with calm eyes that were deeply circled and socketed for all their calmness. If the son had been shocked by the father's appearance, the father was also dully shocked by his son's. To Michael, the boy's eye sockets looked nearly like a skull's vacant orbs in the failing light.
The last name was Welch, yes.
They would be in touch, I suppose. Mom doesn't know that he might have been one of the guys that trashed Christine?
Not from me.
I didn't tell her either. I'd be glad if she didn't find that out. Arnie said.
She may find it out eventually, Michael said. In fact, she almost certainly will. She's an extremely intelligent woman, in case you've never noticed. But she won't find it out from me.
Arnie nodded, then smiled humorlessly.
Where were you last night? Your trust is touching, Dad.
Michael flushed, but his eyes didn't drop. Maybe if you'd been standing outside yourself these last couple of months, he said, you'd understand why I asked.
What the hell does that mean?
You know damn well.
It hardly even bears discussing anymore.
We just go around and around the same old mulberry bush. Your entire life is jittering apart, and you stand there and ask me what I'm talking about.
Arnie laughed. It was a hard, contemptuous sound. Michael seemed to shrivel a little before it.
Mom asked me if I was on drugs. Maybe you want to check that one out, too?
Arnie made as if to push up the sleeves of his warm-up jacket.
Want to check for needle tracks?
I don't need to ask if you're on drugs, Michael said. You're only on one I know of, and that's enough. It's that goddamn car.
Arnie turned as if to go, and Michael pulled him back.
Get your hand off my arm!
Michael dropped his hand.
I wanted you to be aware, he said.
I no more think you'd kill someone than I think you could walk across the Simmons swimming pool. But the police are going to question you, Arnie. And people can look surprised when the police turn up suddenly. To them, surprise can look like guilt.
All of this because some drunk ran over that shitter Welch.
It wasn't like that, Michael said. I got that much out of this fellow Junkins who called me up on the phone. Whoever killed the Welch boy ran him down, and then backed over him, and ran over him again, and backed up again, and...
Stop it!
Arnie said. He suddenly looked sick and frightened, and Michael had much the same feeling Dennis had had on Thanksgiving evening, that in this tired unhappiness, the real Arnie was suddenly close to the surface, perhaps reachable.
It was... Incredibly brutal, Michael said. That's what Junkins said. You see, it doesn't look like an accident at all. It looks like murder.
Murder?
Arnie said, dazed.
No, I never...
What? Michael asked sharply. He grabbed Arnie's jacket again.
What did you say?
Arnie looked at his father. His face was mask-like again.
I never thought it could be that, he said. That's all I was gonna say.
I just wanted you to know, he said. They'll be looking for someone with a motive, no matter how thin. They know what happened to your car, and that the Welch boy might have been involved, or that you might think he was involved. Junkins may be around to talk to you.
I don't have anything to hide.
No, of course not, Michael said.
You'll miss your bus.
Yeah,
Arnie said.
Gotta go.
But he stayed a moment longer, looking at his father. Michael suddenly found himself thinking of Arnie's 9th birthday. He and his son had gone to the little zoo in Philly Plains, had eaten lunch out, and had finished the day by playing 18 holes at the indoor miniature golf course on Outer Basin Drive. That place had burned down in 1975. Regina had not been able to come. She had been flat on her back with bronchitis. The two of them had had a fine time. For Michael, that had been his son's best birthday, the one that symbolized for him, above all others, his son's sweet and uneventful American boyhood. They had gone to the zoo and come back, and nothing much had happened, except that they had had a great time. Michael and his son, who had been, and who still was, so dear to him. He wet his lips and said, "Sell her, Arnie. Why don't you? When she's completely restored, sell her away. You could get a lot of money, a couple, 3,000 maybe." Again, that frightened, tired look seemed to sweep over Arnie's face, but Michael couldn't tell for sure. The sunset had faded to a bitter orange line on the western horizon, and the little yard was dark. Then the look, if it had been there at all, went away.
"No, I couldn't do that, Dad," Arnie said gently, as if speaking to a child. "I couldn't do that now. I've put too much into her. Way too much."
And then he was gone, cutting across the yard to the sidewalk, joining the other shadows, and there was only the sound of his footfalls coming back, soon lost.
"Put too much into her? Have you? Exactly what, Arnie? What have you put into her?"
Michael looked down at the leaves, then around at his yard. Beneath the hedge and under the overhang of the garage, cold snow glimmered in the coming dark, livid and stubbornly waiting for reinforcements. Waiting for winter. Chapter 32. Regina and Michael. Regina was tired. She tired more easily these days, it seemed, and they went to bed together around 9, long before Arnie came in. They made love that was dutiful and joyless. Lately, they made love a lot. It was almost always dutiful and joyless, and Michael had begun having the unpleasant feeling that his wife was using his penis as a sleeping pill. And as they lay in their twin beds after, Michael asked casually, "How did you sleep last night?"
"Quite well," Regina said candidly, and Michael knew she was lying.
"Good." "I came up around 11 and Arnie seemed restless," Michael said, still keeping his voice casual. He was deeply uneasy now. There had been something in Arnie's face tonight, something he hadn't been able to read because of the damned shadows. It was probably nothing, nothing at all, but it glowed in his mind like a baleful neon sign that simply would not shut off. Had his son looked guilty and scared? Or had it just been the light? Unless he could resolve that, sleep would be a long time coming tonight, and it might not come at all.
"I got up around 1, Regina said, then hurried to add, "just to use the bathroom. I checked in on him."
She laughed a little wistfully.
"Old habits die hard, don't they?"
"Yes," Michael said. "I guess they do."
"He was sleeping deeply then. I wish I could get him to wear pajamas in cold weather."
"He was in his skivvies?"
"Yes."
He settled back, immeasurably relieved and more than a little ashamed of himself as well. But it was better to know, for sure. It was all very well for him to tell Arnie that he knew the boy could no more commit a murder than he could walk on water. But the mind, that perverse monkey, the mind can conceive of anything and seems to take a perverse delight in doing so. Just maybe, Michael thought, lacing his hands behind his head and looking up at the dark ceiling, just maybe that's the peculiar damnation of the living. In the mind, a wife can rot, laughing with a best friend. A best friend can cast plots against you and plan backstabbings. A son can commit murder by auto. Better to be ashamed and put the monkey to sleep. Arnie had been here at 1 o'clock. It was unlikely Regina was mistaken about the time because of the digital clock radio on their bureau.
It told the time in numbers that were big and blue and unmistakable. His son had been here at 1 o'clock, and the Welch boy had been run down 3 miles away 25 minutes later. Impossible to believe that Arnie could have dressed, gone out without Regina, who had surely been lying wakeful hearing him, gone down to Darnell's, gotten Christine, and driven out to where Moochie Welch had been killed. Physically impossible. Not that he had ever believed it to begin with. The mind monkey was satisfied. Michael rolled over on his right side, slept, and dreamed that he and his 9-year-old son were playing miniature golf on an endless series of small, astroturfed greens where windmills turned and tiny water hazards lay in wait. And he dreamed that they were alone, all alone in the world, because his son's mother had died in childbirth. Very sad. People still remarked on how inconsolable Michael had been. But when they went home, he and his son, the house would be theirs alone. They would eat spaghetti right from the pot like a couple of bachelor slobs. And when the dishes were washed, they would sit at a kitchen table hidden beneath spread newspapers and build model cars with harmless plastic engines. In his sleep, Michael Cunningham smiled. Beside him, in the other bed, Regina did not. She lay awake and waited for the sound of the door that would tell her that her son had come in from the world outside. When she heard the door open and close, when she heard his step on the stairs, then she would be able to sleep. Maybe. Chapter 33. Junkins. Junkins turned up at Darnell's around 8:45 that evening. Arnie had just finished with Christine for the night. He had replaced the radio antenna that Repperton's gang had snapped off with a new one, and for the last 15 minutes or so, he had been sitting behind the wheel, listening to WDIL's Friday Night Cavalcade of Gold. He had meant to do no more than turn the radio on and dial across once, making sure that he had hooked up the antenna plug properly, and that there was no static. But he had run onto WDIL's strong signal and had sat there, looking straight through the windshield, his gray eyes musing and far away, as Bobby Fuller sang, "I Fought the Law," as Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers sang, "Why Do Fools Fall in Love," as Eddie Cochran sang, "Come On, Everybody," and Buddy Holly sang, "Rave On." There were no commercials on WDIL Friday nights, and no DJs. Just the sounds. Gone from the charts, but not from our hearts. Every now and then a soothing female voice would break in and tell him what he already knew, that he was listening to WDIL Pittsburgh, the sound of blue suede radio. Arnie sat dreaming behind the wheel, the red idiot lights glowing on the dash, tapping his fingers, lightly. The antenna was fine. Yes, he had done a good job. It was like Will said, he had a light touch. Look at Christine. Christine proved it. She had been a hunk of junk sitting on LeBay's lawn, and he had brought her back. Then she had been a hunk of junk sitting in the long-term lot out at the airport, and he had brought her back again. He had what? Replaced the antenna. Yes. And he had popped some of the dents. He could remember that, but he hadn't ordered any glass, although it was all replaced. He hadn't ordered any new seat covers, but they were all replaced, too, and he had only looked closely under the hood once before slamming it back down in horror at the damage they had done to Christine's mill. But now the radiator was whole, the engine block clean and glowing, the pistons moving free and clear, and it purred like a cat. But there had been dreams. He had dreamed of LeBay behind the wheel of Christine, LeBay dressed in an army uniform that was spotted and splotched with blue-gray patches of graveyard mold. LeBay's flesh had sloughed and run, white, gleaming bone poked through in places. The sockets where LeBay's eyes had once been were empty and dark, but something was squirming in there, yes, something. And then Christine's headlights had come on, and someone had been pinned there, pinned like a bug on a white square of cardboard. Someone familiar. Moochie Welch? Maybe. But as Christine suddenly rocketed forward, tires screaming, it had seemed to Arnie that the terrified face out there on the street ran like tallow, changing even as the Plymouth bore down on it. Now
It was Repperton's face. Now, Sandy Galton's. Now it was Will Darnell's heavy, moon face. Whoever was out there had jumped aside, but LeBay had thrown Christine into reverse, working the shift lever with black, rotting fingers. A wedding ring hung on one, as loose as a hoop thrown over the branch of a dead tree. And then he threw it back into drive as the figure raced for the far side of the street, and as Christine bore down again, the head had turned, throwing a terrified glance backward, and Arnie had seen the face of his mother, the face of Dennis Gilder. Lee's face, all eyes under a floating cloud of dark blonde hair, and finally his own face, the twisted mouth forming the words, "No, no, no." Overriding everything, even the heavy thunder of the exhaust, something underneath had been damaged for sure, was LeBay's rotting, triumphant voice, coming from a decayed larynx, passing lips that were already shriveled away from the teeth and tattooed with a delicate spidering of dark green mold. LeBay's triumphant, shrieking voice. "Here you go, you shitter! See how you like it!" There had been the heavy, mortal thud of Christine's bumper striking flesh, the gleam of a pair of spectacles rising in the night air, turning over and over, and then Arnie had awakened in his room, curled into a trembling ball and clutching his pillow. It had been 1:45 in the morning, and his first feeling had been a great and terrible relief. Relief that he was still alive. He was alive. LeBay was dead. And Christine was safe. The only three things in the world that mattered. "Oh, but Arnie, how did you hurt your back?" Some voice inside, sly and insinuating, asking a question he was afraid to answer. "I heard it at Philly Plains," he had told everyone. "One of the junkers started to slip back down the ramp of Will's flatbed, and I pushed it back up. Didn't think about it. I just did it. Strained something really bad." So he had said. And one of the junkers had started to slip, and he had pushed it back up, but that hadn't been how he hurt his back, had it? No. That night, after he and Lee had found Christine smashed to hell in the parking lot, sitting on 4 slash tires, that night at Darnell's, after everyone was gone, he had tuned the radio in Will's office to the oldies on WDIL. Will trusted him now, why not? He was running cigarettes across the state line into New York. He was running fireworks all the way over to Burlington. And twice he had run something wrapped in flat brown paper packages into Wheeling, where a young guy in an old Dodge Challenger traded him another slightly larger brown paper package for it. Arnie thought maybe he was trading cocaine for money, but he didn't want to know for sure. He drove a boat on these trips, Will's private car, a 1966 Imperial as black as midnight in Persia. It was whisper quiet, and the trunk had a false bottom. If you kept to the speed limit, it was no problem. Why should it be? The important thing was that he now had the keys to the garage. He could come in after everyone else was gone, like he had that night. And he had turned on WDIL, and he had hurt his back somehow. What had he been doing to hurt his back? A strange phrase came to him in answer, floating up from his subconscious. "It's just a funny little glitch." Did he really want to know? He didn't. In fact, there were times when he didn't want the car at all. There were times when he felt he would be better off just, well, junking it. Not that he ever would or could. It was just that sometimes, in the sweaty, shaking aftermath of that dream last night, for instance, he felt that if he got rid of it, he would be happier. The radio suddenly spat an almost feline burst of static. "Don't worry," Arnie whispered. He ran his hand slowly over the dashboard, loving the feel of it. Yes, the car frightened him sometimes. And he supposed his father was right. It had changed his life to some degree. But he could no more junk it than he could commit suicide. The static cleared. The Marvelettes were singing, "Please, Mr. Postman." And then a voice said in his ear, "Arnold Cunningham?"
He jumped and snapped off the radio. He turned around. A small, dapper little man was leaning in Christine's window. His eyes were a dark brown, and his color was high from the cold outside, Arnie guessed.
Yes?
Rudolph Junkins, State Police Detective Division? Junkins stuck his hand in through the open window. Arnie looked at it for a moment. So his father had been right. He grinned his most charming grin, took the hand, shook it firmly, and said,
"Don't shoot, copper. I'll throw out my guns."
Junkins returned Arnie's grin, but Arnie noticed that the grin did no more than touch his eyes, which were exploring the car in a quick, thorough fashion that Arnie didn't like. Not at all.
"Woo! I got the feeling from the local police that the guys who worked over your rolling iron had really tattooed it. It sure doesn't look like it."
Arnie shrugged and got out of the car. Friday nights were slow at the garage. Will himself rarely came in, and he wasn't in tonight. Across the way in stall 10, a fellow named Gabs was putting a new muffler on his old Valiant, and down at the far end of the garage, there was the periodic burr of an air wrench as some fellow put on his snow tires. Otherwise, he and Junkins had the place to themselves.
"It wasn't anywhere near as bad as it looked," Arnie said.
He thought that this smiling, dapper little man might be extremely clever. As if it was a natural outgrowth of the thought, he rested his hand easily on Christine's roof and immediately felt better. He could cope with this man, clever or not. After all, what was there to worry about?
There was no structural damage.
"Oh? I understood they punched holes in the body with some sharp instrument," Junkins said, looking closely at Christine's flank.
"I'll be damned if I can see the fill. You must be a bodywork genius, Arnie. The way my wife drives, maybe I ought to put you on retainer."
He smiled disarmingly, but his eyes went on running back and forth over the car. They would dart momentarily to Arnie's face and then go back to the car again. Arnie liked it less and less.
"I'm good, but not God," Arnie said. "You can see the bodywork if you really look for it."
He pointed at a minute ripple in Christine's back deck.
"And there," he pointed at another. "I was lucky enough to find some original Plymouth body parts up in Ruggles. I replaced the entire back door on this side. You see the way the paint doesn't quite match?"
He knocked his knuckles on the door.
"Nope," Junkins said. "I might be able to tell with a microscope, Arnie, but it looks like a perfect match to me."
He also knocked his knuckles on the door. Arnie frowned.
"Hell of a job," Junkins said. He walked slowly around to the front of the car.
"Hell of a job, Arnie. You're to be congratulated."
"Thanks."
He watched as Junkins, in the guise of the sincere admirer, used his sharp brown eyes to look for suspicious dents, flaked paint, maybe a spot of blood or a snarl of matted hair, looking for signs of Moochie Welch. Arnie was suddenly sure that was just what the shitter was doing.
"What exactly can I do for you, Detective Junkins?"
Junkins laughed. "Man, that's formal. I can't take that. Make it Rudy, okay?"
"Sure," Arnie said, smiling. "What can I do for you, Rudy?"
"You know, it's funny," Junkins said, squatting to look at the driver's side headlights. He tapped one of them reflectively with his knuckles, and then, with seeming absent-mindedness, ran his forefinger along the headlight's semicircular metal hood. His overcoat pooled on the oil-stained cement floor for a moment. Then he stood up. "We get reports on anything of this nature. The trashing of your car, I mean."
"Oh, hey, they didn't really trash it,"
Arnie said. He was beginning to feel as if he was on a tightrope, and he touched Christine again. Her solidity, her reality, once more seemed to comfort him.
"They tried, you know, but they didn't do a very good job."
"Okay. I guess I'm not up on the current terminology," Junkins laughed. "Anyway, when it came to my attention, what do you think I said? Where's the photographs?" "That's what I said. I thought it was an oversight, you know. So I called the Libertyville PD and they said there were no photographs."
"No," Arnie said. "A kid my age can't get anything but liability insurance, you know that. Even the liability comes with a $700 deductible. If I had damage insurance, I would have taken plenty of pictures, but since I didn't, why would I? I sure wouldn't want them for my scrapbook."
"No, I guess not," Junkins said,
and walked idly around to the rear of the car, eyes searching for broken glass, for scrapes, for guilt.
But you know what else I thought was funny? You didn't even report the crime.
He raised his dark, questioning eyes to Arnie's, looked at him closely, and then smiled a phony, bewildered little smile.
Didn't even report it.
Huh, I said.
Son of a bitch. Who reported it?
Guy's father, they tell me.
Junkin shook his head.
I don't get that, Arnie.
I don't mind telling you. A guy works his ass off for storing an old car until it's worth $2,000, maybe $5,000. And some guys come along and beat the hell out of it